You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. A few years ago, I was at a friend's house in the Hudson Valley, and I picked up a book from her shelf by a writer my friend had met at an arts colony, and his name was Stephen Cusisto, and that book was called Planet of the Blind, and I really loved that book. So I was so thrilled when I had the opportunity to invite Steve to Aloud, and that I have the honor of interviewing him tonight. And I'm also so grateful to the Braille Institute, which is co-sponsoring tonight's program. Please, Braille Institute, so thrilled. I want to thank the staff there for their support, with special thanks to Reed Strigge for his enthusiasm for tonight, and to Sally Coleman, and to Jennifer Essen, former Braille Institute staffer, who first suggested this collaboration. It's taken a while, but here we are tonight. I'm just going to give you a brief intro tonight, and I'm glad we have some guest dog canines in the audience. We're very thrilled to have you here as well. Stephen Cusisto is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He was a Fulbright Scholar. He currently teaches at Syracuse University, where he holds a university professorship in disability studies. His other books include the memoirs Planet of the Blind and Eavesdropping, a Memoir of Blindness and Listening, and as well the poetry collections Only Bread, Only Light, and Letter to Borges. His new book is called Have Dog Will Travel, A Poet's Journey, and it's a lyrical love letter and a dog-driven invitation to living full forward. And how is it? I'm going to keep this introduction very short because I can't wait to talk to Steve. Please join me in welcoming Steve Cusisto. Great.
Come here, puppy. Look at all those people. Look at all those people. Yay.
Steve Cusisto and Caitlin, I should say.
And Caitlin. Come here, puppy.
You're going to sit.
Come right here. Okay. Yeah. Hi, honey. Can you sit?
Thank you all so much for coming. And Stephen, before we, first of all, I just want to say that this, as I think I've told you, I really love this book, and I'm really grateful for it because, first of all, Stephen is such a beautiful writer, and he really uses his poet's sensibility to make experiences which would not be accessible otherwise to so many of us, and to make them tangible and to make them sensory. And I'm not sure exactly of your intended audience, but I certainly feel like the book hit home with me because you note few... This is a direct quote from you. Few people understand working dogs in particular and blindness in general.
That's true.
I think that's really true. You were raised in the 50s, as was I, but you were raised before the Americans with Disability Act, which was in 1990, correct? And which is maybe something that many of us here have come to take for granted. It wasn't that long ago, though. And I wish you would start maybe by telling us a little bit about your youth before the Americans with Disability Act, when you basically managed to not let on that you were blind, that you were disabled in that way. How did that work for you, and why was that?
Well, so first of all, thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
And thank all of you for coming out tonight. Namaste. Let me just say that my story really isn't all that unusual. It's mm-hmm. really tempting to think, oh, Steve Cusisto wrote a story about trying to pass for a sighted person in the early 60s. That story is really legion among people who are blind and visually impaired. Even today, all over the U.S., around the world, right? People don't necessarily want to be known for their disability. And they think, well, you know, if I can fake it till I make it, that's okay, right? I can do that. Moreover, of course, depends on where you live as to whether or not you're going to meet people with disabilities or those who really have a vested interest in helping them with good education, good programming, good support services. It is, for instance, much harder for people with disabilities who live in very rural places.
And where were you growing up?
Well, I was growing up in rural New Hampshire. And New Hampshire is still not a great state when it comes to social services. They have a state motto, you may know it, live free or die. What that means is we don't pay any taxes here, and if you need social help of any kind, you're on your own. That's still the case in New Hampshire. So it ranks near the bottom nationally in social services. So that doesn't mean there aren't good people doing good work in New Hampshire, let's just be clear, but it is the case that if you live in the middle of nowhere, whatever you might want to, you know, label as nowhere, you may have a hard time, especially if you become disabled in midlife or later, you may have a hard time finding the kinds of programs and support mechanisms that will help you, right? I used to work at the University of Iowa with eye doctors, and they were fond of pointing out that the worst thing an eye doctor can say to a patient losing her or his vision is, quote, I'm sorry, there's nothing more I can do for you. Because what happens then, right? That person leaves the eye doctor's clinic and goes home and moves into the back room behind the family farm and never comes back out.
Your parents were well-educated. Your mother had gone to law school.
No, she was accepted to law school.
She was accepted at law school. But one of the things she told you that you say in the book is never let people see you're, quote, defective. Not talking, and you say not talking about it became its own drama. So could you talk a little bit about that family dynamic of the time and you know how that played out in your hometown?
Yeah, so everybody knows this dynamic. You have an alcoholic relative, you have someone in the family who is queer and doesn't know how to find the language and the opportunity to speak up for themselves. There are lots of ways in which we contain people, and dysfunctional families are really expert at this, right? There's a narrative being written by the chief drunk or, you know, the patriarch that puts people in their assigned roles, and it's hard to overcome those. So again, this isn't really a singular story about me. It's a story about 1950s and 60s America, where, according to my mother, I wouldn't have any entree into mainstream society if I presented as disabled. Well, that's not all that unusual, right? I mean, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was arguably the most powerful person in the world, and he would not reveal his disability in public and actually created an elaborate stage mechanism to hide that disability where possible. Now imagine that, right? So if the president of the United States is hiding his disability, then what's a mother to do of a disabled child in rural New Hampshire? Hide that disability if possible, right? So that's not a good way to live. I'm not advocating for it. I don't think it's a good idea. But that was one of the struggles that I had to work against, and which I think many people have to work against when disability or some other kind of historically marginalized position enters into, you know.
And I want to talk about the development of, you know, as you later on when you move into the guide dog school, as your, you know, understanding of your mother's situation and or how she saw this at the time, kind of you have more context for it. But tell us a little bit about how you coped during those years. How you, quote, you have this quote from Lead Belly where he talks about playing, quote, sighted man's chicken. And you talk about pretending to see. You got to keep something moving all the time. What were your strategies for acting sighted in a world where you were struggling with being able to see and not see?
Well, sighted man chicken is my phrase, not Lead Belly's.
Okay, it's a pretty good phrase.
Lead Belly, however, was the virtuoso of the 12-string guitar, and some squarehead asked him, how do you play that thing? And he said, you got to keep something moving all the time. Right? That's how you play that thing. So I'm, you know, leaning on Lead Belly there for a kind of a comic interlude. If you can't see and you're trying to present as sighted, you just throw yourself into the world willy-nilly in a kind of a madcap way. And I was pretty good at that. I bounced a lot. I fell down. I got up. I kept going. I took a lot of risks. again, I want to remind you, this is a really common story.
But people, right. What, riding motorcycles?
Well, I did do that. And
on a small island with
on
cliffs?
On a small island in Greece, I was with other college students, all who could see, and I decided I was going to go do what they did. And I survived it, barely. The great thing about Greece, though, in those days at least, was that nobody needed a license to rent a motorbike. They didn't care. You know, oh, yeah, okay, great. So I did do that. But, you know, I mean, I know people losing their vision who refuse to give up driving, right? You know, I mean, it's that kind of liminal space where there's a fear that if you are more overtly honest about disablement, you'll be rejected, right? And that's the flip side of my mother's idea. Go out in the world and pretend to see, right? Well, okay, yeah, you can do that, but it doesn't mean you like yourself. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean you feel good about the hours and the minutes of that life. And it takes a long time to achieve that kind of breakthrough.
Your phrase, you say, my blindness became a tortoise-like affair. My blind soul stayed quiet in its shell.
Right. I did say that.
I mean, in the sense that you couldn't express it, you had to, you know, withhold it. You had to pretend to be otherwise.
Yeah, well, how do you find the language for your own unique position, mm-hmm. right? In my case, there were multiple ways forward, right? Reading. I got a lot out of reading African-American writers in particular. Everyone from James Baldwin to Toni Morrison mm-hmm. to Audre Lorde, but also reading in psychoanalysis and psychology, reading people like Carl Jung, James Hillman, and others. Then finally, of course, there comes a moment where I began reading self-help books because I was spending a lot of time trying to fix my mother, who was not only really ill-disposed toward my being disabled, but she was a drunk. And you know, Simon & Schuster says to me, was there proofreading the book, is your mother dead? And I said, yes. And they said, oh, good. Because, you know, you don't say much that's very nice about her. And I said, yeah, well, it is true. I mean, if you live in a family with profound alcoholism or mm-hmm. drug addiction issues, one of the things that you begin to become aware of, if you're lucky, and I got this from Al-Anon, going to therapy talking sessions for people who lived in families with alcoholism, right? I learned that this powerful drunk person is creating a narrative all the time that you have to fit into according to an assigned role that they give you. And they're really good at that. They tend to be very, very persuasive people. And, you know, so, yeah, I just set fire to the sofa, but I did it for you. You know, and you say, oh, really? Yeah, okay. Well, so it takes time to begin to realize that this is not in accord with the best principles of healthy living.
So it sort of worked for a while. You know, you were 38. You taught in a small town at a college, and you memorized your way around the town. You could get around okay. But then something happened. You lost your job, and it necessitated making a pretty drastic change. And I wonder if you could, as you were contemplating those changes and what you were going to do, I wonder if you could read the section. It starts with, one morning I had a visit from a man. You were trying to figure out what you were going to do next. How were you going to get another job after, you know, being a college professor in this small town? It wasn't easy when you were sending out your resumes.
So, yeah, I was unemployed suddenly, and I'd created a life where I could live in a small provincial space. And then I realized I had no idea how to find a job in the larger world, right? I just didn't know. And I called the State Commission for the Blind, thinking they could help.
They were really helpful.
And then this happened. One morning I had a visit from a man who worked for the New York State Commission for the Blind. He was affable, even buoyant. He sat on my couch and bounced up and down. It was fun. He said he wanted to help me find a new job. We discussed my resume for 20 minutes, and then without warning, he said, I don't think you'll ever find work. I sat across from him in a rocking chair and said nothing. I was quiet as a lump of moss. Then he added, just to break the silence, that he knew a company that made plastic lemons, the ones you find in the grocery with lemon juice inside. He said sometimes they hired blind people. I might be able to sort fake lemons. I saw myself in a dark shed wearing a suit made of starlight and juggling lemons. When he left, I sat for a long time. It seemed I had three problems. I was sad. I had to learn how to walk in a larger world. And I had to trust I could do this.
I love that passage. You describe yourself subsequently as, I love this phrase, a grown man who came late to walking free. So you were 38 when you got yourself to the Guide Dogs for the Blind in Westchester County, north of New York City. And a number of things struck me, and you can tell me what first struck you when you got there, but the first thing that struck me was how little you'd been around other blind people. I mean, you were there in a community, and that seemed to be a huge revelation to you.
Yeah, well, first of all, blindness is a low-incidence disability, as every blind person here knows. There aren't that many blind people in the United States. In fact, actually, we don't know how many there are. It's a kind of guesstimate. But we guess that there are about 1 million blind people in the U.S. Under the age of 65, and maybe another 2 million over 65. That's a generous estimate. So there might be as many as 3 million, but it could be as small as, 1.5 million. So the odds of meeting other blind people, especially if you live in a rural place, they're not too good, right? I went to the guide dog school to train with a dog, and man, I've got all these blind classmates who were a hoot.
They sounded amazing.
I mean, they were great. They had every kind of coping skill and hilarious story and, multiple backgrounds, and they came from around the world, and that was really amazing.
And they were all there to be matched with a guide dog, and you were matched with Corky, or Miss Corky, as you say, and you say it was even a little bit like an arranged marriage because you were thrust into a wedding before you even knew each other. And I love this description of meeting Corky. If you could read, it starts, Corky burst in like a clown, which is just a great phrase to start with.
So yeah, they don't give you the dog right away, right? You have to spend time with the trainers, and they teach you about, basics about the dog.
And they're deciding, right, which dog to give you.
And they're trying to decide what dog to give you because they have more trained dogs than they have customers, because they want to make sure that the dog is fast enough for you or, whatever. And so there's anticipation, right? You've got 2 days before they give you a dog. And I went there thinking, oh, they're just going to give me a dog. It'll be like picking up a car. I'll get the dog. I'll go home. It'll be simple. And no, you had to learn stuff. And they make you wait. Anyway, finally they call me and they say, come on down. And it's like a game show, and you come in the room, and Corky burst in like a clown. I sat in a tall armchair, and Kylie, that's the trainer, told me to call, and damned if she didn't run full steam into my arms. She placed her large front paws on my shoulders and washed my face. And then, as if she fully understood her job would require comedy, she nibbled my nose. She was brilliant and silly. I couldn't believe my luck. Back in our room, she bounced, cocked her head, backed up, ran in circles, and came back. All the while, I kept talking. Oh, let's go anywhere we choose, I said, feeling I was on the verge of tears.
I cried many times reading this book. You have to become... you said in this process, an amateur Buddhist, and I love that. And one of the ways that seems to happen is once you have this dog, you have to practice praise. And you talk about praise being the secret ingredient. Could you talk a little bit about that, just the idea of what praise represents?
Yeah, well, so guide dogs are trained with positive reinforcement and rewards, right? And they love praise, and they love it when you praise them with a really warm, happy voice. So we actually had a class where they taught us about praising the dogs. This is before we even get the dogs. And, you know, and so we're just practicing this and saying, good dog, good dog, right? You know, and it suddenly dawned on me that throughout my life, from grade school to college, graduate school, nobody had ever said a thing to me about praise. That, in fact, I knew nothing about praise. I mean, you know, if you grew up in a dysfunctional family, praise, zero, right? But even in grade school or even in graduate school, praise? No, your job is to, you know, vanquish the person next to you by, you know, getting a better grade or, you know, stealing their crayons or whatever, right? So praise, what a concept. And all day long with a guide dog, when they stop for a stair, when they stop for a curb, when they guide you around a low branch, when they take evasive maneuvers because there's a careening skateboarder, the dog is trained to do all these amazing things, and they do them unfailingly, but it's still your job to say, good dog. And so I do this, you know, I mean, 45 times a day.
So it starts working on your feedback system. I mean, it's...
It becomes second nature, right? And if you're praising another creature all the time, guess what? You're also praising yourself because you're a team.
So beautiful. You have these beautiful lyrical descriptions that of what you call it walking free feels like. What it, you know, you here you've been, you know, trying to get around on your own and doing a fairly good job, but suddenly you're walking free, and you say it's like floating. You use the phrase, you feel an omnidirectional confidence. And I just wondered if you could talk a little about forwardness and what that felt like when you first started navigating with Miss Corky.
So guide dogs are trained to pull. They're not like your family dog who's trained to heel. And they pull in part because that's how they establish an unbroken connectedness with you. So they're looking two blocks ahead, and they're watching everything. And they're pulling, and they're taking evasive action based on things that you haven't even arrived at yet. They see a block ahead, somebody, you know, coming with a bicycle, and they're already making moves to evade and avoid that. But they're doing it without ever breaking stride. So you're going fast with the dog. There's no slack in a guide dog harness. And so that you're moving in an unbroken high-speed way. And it's like running. You're moving along at a really good clip. Now, the other thing is, if the dog stops suddenly because there's no slack in that harness, you stop too. And you're trained, don't step in front of your dog. So the dog hits the brakes, you stop with the dog, and you wait to figure out what's going on, right? It's also the case that the dog might back up suddenly. Well, if they do that, again, there's no slack in a harness. So when they back up, you back up. And I'm alive today because Corky once backed up in New York City, and a bus went roaring right past my nose that I had not heard because the wind was blowing in just the right way that I couldn't hear traffic. And I'm not here to put down white cane users, but had I been using my white cane, I'd have been struck and killed. The dog is watching, and she took an evasive move and backed up fast, and I went with her, and that bus just whisked right by my face.
You could feel it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're moving fast. You're moving in confidence. The dog is making all kinds of decisions, and you're just sailing, you know.
They're amazing descriptions. I mean, it really, the language that you use to describe it, there's several words and phrases, kind of key phrases that I thought would be kind of great if you could talk about. One of them is a word that I don't think sighted people rarely think about, which is reachable. You talk about how all with a dog, all at once, everything is reachable, and reachable is one of the main coordinates of independence. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, okay. I mean, I think you can be independent with a white cane, so don't get me wrong. You can learn great orientation and mobility techniques and go wherever you want to go. In my case, however, while I am a good white cane user, I found with the dog an extra level of confidence. And what that meant for me is that I could easily picture myself and then subsequently realize myself going to New York City, a place I love, by myself and doing all kinds of things with eagerness and fluidity and joy and a sense of accomplishment and safety that I would not have found without this wonderful dog by my side. So that meant going to New York, hopping on the 7 train in the subway in Grand Central, heading out to see the Mets play the Dodgers just by myself, right? Going to a jazz club, just doing things with a kind of spontaneity, right? Which is part of the coordinates of independence.
Read this passage about your trip to New York. I love. It starts, "We were in a good dream all day when you and Miss Corky go to New York by yourselves without anyone, a trainer or anything."
Yeah, so we were in a good dream all day. Corky and I walked the Brooklyn Bridge. The sky was blue going to green as we raced along the promenade deck. It was easy to imagine men in swallow-tailed coats and women with wide hats approaching. Blindness was all mist for me, and yet that dear light was wonderful. For people like me, light is a mystery, a literal one, less of physics, more a matter of interpretation. I live in unfocused brilliance. We were going very fast in a jogger's reverie, Corky and I. We passed 2 slow runners. I wondered what Corky's waking dream was like.
And then just that next paragraph, I thought.
I thought how a dog's vision must be like widescreen cinema, what they used to call Panavision. The whole world must be wide and bright for a dog. The entire day must be like watching Ben-Hur, a sequence of dazzling chariot races. It was amusing to think of it. Every day is a big screen Hollywood spectacle for a dog.
That's so great. And what does, tell me about what is intelligent disobedience, which I thought was a phrase that would be very useful in everyday life.
Right. So guide dogs are trained in this thing called intelligent disobedience, which sounds, you know, like jumbo shrimp. But it's a real thing. And basically what it is that dogs know not to step in front of a moving car if they're seeing it. Now, the dog who's chasing a squirrel isn't seeing that moving car, and it gets run over because it's got squirrel tunnel vision, right? But the guide dog is trained to watch for traffic. It's early in the training, right? And then it's trained to know that it has to make intelligent choices about crossing that street. And this is what they call intelligent disobedience. It's taking advantage of a dog's instinct. Mm. The dog learns that it has to take matters into its own paws. And so it learns that if the handler says forward and a car is coming and it's not safe, that it has to countermand that order and not do it.
Wow.
That's what's called intelligent disobedience. And that is the point in guide dog training where the majority of dogs flunk out. And it's not because they're stupid. It's not because they're cowardly. But it's because they're too sensitive for this. They decide, oh, my God, there's a stunt driver. It's coming straight for me. It's up to me to make this decision. They make the right decision, but then they decide, I don't want to do this anymore. And so those dogs are very sensitive, and they become great pets. But the real guide dog is the one that says, wow, I'm good at this.
I'm standing my ground. I'm not giving in.
Yeah.
We learn a lot in your book about your developing sense of empathy, which I found so beautiful and so fascinating. You quote Plato, be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a harder battle. And this was both from the dog perspective and from the human perspective. You have to know how not to hurt each other. And so as you're developing this empathy, you also, I mean, it's very, very moving to me. You develop an empathy for your mother, what she went through, you know, even though you may not agree with the choices she made for you at the time. There's a woman, you call it your foundational moment, someone who said something to you as a child when you were with your parents in Finland, and even yourself, and for people who don't understand guide dogs, could you talk a little bit about that developing sense of empathy that kind of came about as you started to work with a dog?
Well, I think the dog helped bring that out for me.
Hmm.
I describe earlier in the book how as a teenager with anorexia, and an alcoholic mother and no place to turn in life and feeling outcast, that I really developed anorexia and was starving myself to death. And that is a sad story, but I describe how I went to an Episcopal service, took the Eucharist, and suddenly felt this very strong sense that taking that bread and drinking that wine had a amazingly dynamic, powerful, lyrical quality of life affirmation for me. So once you start to say, my life has value, and I can learn to like this life, and you decide that there are good people in the world, and that there are lots of them, then you begin to say, I'm sad for my mother. I'm sad for my neighbor who, you know, is so utterly, brutally mean to his wife and his children. I'm sad for all kinds of people. And yet, right, my job is, as best I understand it, to understand them, to take a broader perspective, right? And in literature, we call this comic irony, right? It's where you sort of say, well, all right, I'm in a situation, but what if it's not about me? What if there's something else going on?
98% rule. It's not about me.
Right.
Right.
That's not easy to cultivate, but it's the core of emotional intelligence. So the more empathy you can cultivate, the more flexible you are in difficult situations and circumstances.
Which you're in a lot, because as you we move into the section where you're out in the world with your dog, and you say, with a service dog, you become a, quote, sacred, profound, wandering totem, and there's no help for it. I mean, people feel free to project onto you. They feel free to pray over you. I mean, your blindness becomes obvious to people as you're walking with the dog, and yet you enter these situations. There's one that really struck me. There's so many of them in the book, and they're great scenes. Steve's a great scene writer. Where you go into this computer store in New York, you just want to buy a computer, and there's a guard. Could you tell us about that situation? This may be someone who's never seen someone with a guide dog before.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I go into the store, and the guard who's, you know, been hired with no training and has little command of English says no dog allowed and, you know, insists on this, and I explain to him that it's a guide dog, And a couple customers start to shout at the guy, don't you know it's a guide dog? What's wrong with you?
And he's also, you think, from, he's
well, so I can tell from his accent that he's from somewhere in Africa. And, you know, I mean, I say to him, look, it's okay. It's a special dog. And then the manager comes running up, and he's one of those red-faced, put-upon, miserable dudes you meet in New York all the time, right? And, you know,
I can just see him.
Yeah, well, you can, right? He's the manager of the electronics store on 7th Avenue, and he's, you know, his name is Phil, and he starts yelling at this guy, and I start saying, look, you know, let's all pet the dog. Let's talk about the dog, right? And pretty soon, you know, I've got Phil, the manager, saying, these are the best dogs in the world. And Ekweme, the guy from Africa, you know, he thinks this is the most fabulous thing. And customers come up and start talking about guide dogs and how wonderful they are. And we're having this happy moment, right? And I think that's incredibly important.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I sort of describe that scene toward the end as a kind of moment in which I understood something that Dr. King said about how you have to take these steps toward understanding the rights of everyone.
Mm.
And that when you do that, then we're all together on the stairs, right? And, you know, I mean, that's...
You're bringing everyone along.
That's what that's about, right? I mean, my civil rights are not different from your civil rights or anyone else's civil rights. We're all in this together. And that's what it is to, you know, care about our friends and neighbors, you know.
That's really great. I really love that. You said that when you were first approached to write this book by a publisher, they had suggested that you write a book on the history of guide dogs, you know, because apparently there isn't one for the lay public. And you thought about that, and you started off on that. And there's a kind of mini history that you do have in this book, which became a memoir. There's two names in there, and I thought maybe you could just tell us a little bit about the history of guide dogs. One of them is Dr. Gerhard Stalling, who tells, and we learn from that story, how guide dogs were a consequence of war. And the other one is Morris Frank, who was the first guide dog user in the United States. And then I was going to have you read a little bit from your Morris Frank moment. But tell us a little bit about how that the idea got started to use guide dogs for the blind.
Well, I like to make a joke that the guide dog is the only good thing ever invented by the German army.
That's a good joke. It's a good joke.
There were a lot of blinded soldiers after World War I, and that had much to do with the use of gas warfare. And in fact, there's a famous painting by John Singer Sargent of the gassed war veterans all holding onto each other, blindfolded, moving through the mustard gas, which I think is called the gas attack. Not sure, but in any event, blinded veterans were suddenly really everywhere. Gerhard Stalling was a physician who quickly figured out that they had been successfully training dogs in war to deliver messages, deliver medical supplies in the ferocious trenches of the war, really brutal places, and that those dogs had stamina and courage and could withstand, real tough conditions. And he thought, well, why couldn't we train them to guide blinded soldiers? Mm. And so really quite quickly, they established the first guide dog training school in Germany and in Potsdam. And really straight away, they figured out this was a home run, right? They didn't have the term home run in Germany, but, it really was. And that this captivated the public's imagination. Pretty soon, there are guide dog schools all over Europe into Scandinavia. Morris Frank was a young American athlete, a boxer who lost his sight through a boxing accident, and was a largely unsuccessful white cane user, though he did learn how to navigate that way. But in any event, he read an article in the Saturday Evening Post, which in the late 20s was the most popular magazine in the United States. And that article was by a woman named Dorothy Eustace, who was an expatriate American socialite living in Switzerland who had discovered that there were guide dogs. Hmm. She herself was not a guide dog trainer, but she was a trainer of German shepherds. And her interest was in perfecting or bringing back the German shepherd, which she felt as a breed had been diminished by overbreeding. So she was trying to cultivate better, healthier German shepherds. When at a dog show somewhere in Germany, she discovered the guide dog and was so stunned by this that she wrote an article about it for the Saturday Evening Post. Young Morris Frank reads this article and decides to write to Dorothy Eustace, care of the Saturday Evening Post. It takes, a month for the letter to get to her. She lives in Switzerland. He asks her if he comes to Switzerland, would she train a dog for him? She says yes. She hires a dog trainer from a German guide dog school, and young Morris Frank takes a train and then an ocean liner and then another train to Vevey, Switzerland, home also, by the way, of Charlie Chaplin. And gets his first guide dog, who was a German shepherd named Buddy. He and Buddy come back to the U.S. aboard an ocean liner. Word reaches New York that this miraculous thing is about to happen, that a blind man with a trained dog trained to guide him in traffic is about to get off on the West Side Highway. The New York press shows up. Then as now, the press is a little bit suspicious and uppity, and they say, yeah, that dog can't guide you. What are you talking about? And he says, sure can. And they say, show us. And of course, the dog guides him across the West Side Highway through lethal traffic. And the images of this go around the world. It's the beginning of the, the UPI and the AP, and the ability to send photographs around the planet. And that was an image that captured the world's attention. And so overnight, Morris Frank and Buddy are a sensation. 1 year later, he brings Dorothy Eustace to the U.S., and they start the first American guide dog school, which is still extant. It's called The Seeing Eye. It's located in Morristown, New Jersey. It's a wonderful program. And Morris Frank then led the civil rights movement for guide dog users over the next
took a while.
Several decades of his life with multiple guide dogs to open the doors to public acceptance for the guide dog. He was an indomitable, fabulous force.
So you evoke him in this kind of hilarious passage on page 93. One day, seven of the whole class went to a local supermarket. On day seven.
Yeah, so we're in the stage of training where, where is this?
On day seven, the whole class went to a local supermarket. Might get you there.
Yeah, it took me to the wrong passage.
Try the whole class went to a local supermarket.
Well, so yeah, I'm writing about that. We would all be ambassadors for the guide dog movement. And, Corky and I entered the A&P through the familiar electric door and proceeded to walk among mountains of oranges. We walked rather deftly through an intersection of pineapples and packaged roses, and then we hit the cheese section, where Corky was literally stunned by the fragrances of Asiago and Blue, Gruyere and Parmesan. I don't know which cheese stopped her in her tracks, maybe the Fontina, with its odor of honey and mushrooms, but she hit the brakes, raised her head, and scented deeply. She stopped so fast I ran into her and stumbled slightly. Corky was stupefied. I wonder if Morris Frank had a moment like this, the heroic guide dog and man clobbered by Brie and Camembert. I asked myself, what would Morris Frank do?
I love that. And then there's so much in this book, but we must recognize that it's both a love story for a man and his dog, but it's also another kind of a love story because one of the best lines is in the book, I was 40 and walked straight into a love story written by Labradors. So who else did Corky introduce you to?
Yeah, so this is a book without a plot, which is not so easy to write, you know. And damn if you're working on a book without a plot. People keep going, what's it about? And you have to say, well, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's like clouds. And but of course it is a book with a plot. It's just that it's not a dramatic plot. It's about falling in love. It's a love story. It's about falling in love with a dog. And then the dog, Corky, meets a Labrador named Roscoe.
Who's a dropout, right?
Who's a dropout from the guide dog school. And Roscoe's owner is Connie, who is a guide dog trainer who works at the guide dog school doing admissions work. And so Roscoe and Corky become buddies, and then Connie and I fall in love, right? So we're brought together by two dogs.
Pretty great.
Yeah.
And you're still together.
Yes.
It's a beautiful story. And I don't even know, I don't even want to ask you about, there's a beautiful description of your last days with Corky at the end of this marvelous book. You describe her as not just your dog, but as, quote, wisdom's gift. And that's pretty high praise. And I thought maybe before we opened up to questions from the audience, we could end with a poem that you wrote for Corky called Guiding Eyes.
Yeah, let's do that. So this is from another book.
Beautiful book called Only Bread, Only Light.
Called Only Bread, Only Light, yeah. And it's a collection of poems. And I guess I wrote this poem for Corky. She was still very much alive. And we'd spent a lot of time in New York together. And I felt the need to write this. So, yeah, it is a poem. It's got some mythology in it. I allude to Greek mythology and Roman mythology. The centaur, of course, as you know, half man, half donkey, which in the ancient world was really an homage to our own animal qualities. I mentioned Minerva, the Roman goddess of wisdom who always had two owls riding on her shoulders. I don't think you need to know more than that, really. Guiding eyes, Corky, a yellow Labrador. That's the epigraph. It's been 5 years since I was paired with this dog, who in fact is more than a dog. She watches for me. Our twin minds go walking. And I suspect as we entered the subway on Lexington that we're a kind of centaur, or maybe two owls riding the shoulders of Minerva. The traffic squalls and plunges at Columbus Circle, seethes down Broadway, and we step out into the blackness that alarmed Pascal, the emptiness between stars. All blind people know this. Hmm. So you make that choice. Right. I suppose we're scarcely whole, if I think on it. We walk on a dead branch, two moths still attached, the inert day poised above us, the walls of the canyon looming. Did I think on it? A blessing opens by degrees, and I must walk both bodily and ghostly down Fifth Avenue, increasing my devotion full much to the postulate of arrival, to how I love this inexhaustible dog who leads me past jackhammers and the police barriers of New York. All day, snow falls on the disorderly crowds. It clothes Miss Corky until her tawny fur carries the milky dirt of ocean and stone. The centaur gathers what passes from our flesh into the heart of animal faith. Meanwhile, she guides me home.
Hmm. So beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much, Stephen. We'd love to hear your questions. We have folks with microphones. If you raise your hand, we'll come around to you, and you can ask Stephen a question. Or I'll keep firing that. We've got one up here. Okay, good.
Hello. As I listen to you talk, there's a very strong visual element and just very strong clarity, and you're very positive. I'm wondering if that's coming from the circumstances you've had to overcome or just you having a strong spirit. Because it's, you know, I can follow along with you very clearly in everything you say. So I'm just wondering what that's attributed to.
That's a great question. Mm. So there are probably as many answers as I could, you know, invent randomly, right? I mean, I think, for instance, all nouns are images. So if I write battleship or strawberry or tennis shoe, right, you'll see that. And like most poets, I'm good with nouns.
Right? And verbs, too.
Well, verbs, yeah, sure. But, you know, images in poetry really depend on nouns. And so having studied poetry, both the undergraduate and graduate level, I learned a lot about imagery. And so is my version of the Statue of Liberty really the Statue of Liberty? No. In fact, I really have never seen the Statue of Liberty. So, but I can write about it. So that's in a way the trick of creative writing, and it's useful to point that out. Secondly, my optimism comes from having the good fortune of meeting a lot of good people in my lifetime and recognizing along the way that you can choose to be with good people and you don't have to slavishly go on and on with the bad ones. You know, the American poet William Carlos Williams wrote, I think quite meaningfully at one point, divorce is the sign of knowledge in our times. I'm not advocating that you all go out and get divorced. But there is truth to this, that you give up on something that isn't going well. And that's a reflection of arriving at a stage of growth. And, I mean, is it possible to stay in a bad marriage and both of you get better? Of course. Not so good with an alcoholic mother who never got better, right? So I knew I had to get better. And that's work. It takes work. But it's good work. It's the real work. What is it? The American poet Gary Snyder says, the real work. That's changing the inside, making it better, more spacious, loving. So I've worked hard on that, and I appreciate that comment because everyone here knows this is work. You know, it's rough.
Stephen has an epigram on his book, too. I love this, from Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the Tibetan Buddhist teacher. The ultimate definition of bravery is not being afraid of who you are.
Yeah.
It seems very relevant to this, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any question?
Okay. I was just wondering, how would you be able to fake vision in college when you have to do a lot of reading and papers and it was long before computers?
Right. Great question. So I had to have a legion of readers, and I did have readers, and I had to have a lot of stuff on tape. Remember those terrible tape cassette players from the Library of Congress, and the tapes would tangle up and be chewed to pieces, and you've got to finish this book, and it's all tangled up and miserable. I had more incompletes in college than anybody in that college's history. Everybody else went on vacation. I did not. You know, so I worked really, really hard. But I still wasn't willing to tell people, you know, beyond a very limited circle, right, how difficult it was, right? So that was the double edge of it, right?
You know. Did you do it in 4 years?
I did it in 5. Probably could have done it in 4 because I never, you know, took a vacation. But I did take a half a year off to go to the woods in Vermont and write poetry. Yeah. It was my Gary Snyder moment. Went to the woods. I said, if Robert Bly and Gary Snyder can do it.
I have 2 questions down here, Hori. Oh, good. Over there.
Hi. My husband and I have a
exactly.
Dog.
I agree.
That's my dog. My husband and I are raising our second guide dog puppy.
Yay.
Thank you. Our first one is in for formal training, and she's due to graduate in July. This one is only 5 months old, so she's a little young. And I guess 2 things. One, I wanted to just commend you on the way you talk about empathy, because as much as I love my husband, and I love my sisters and brothers-in-law, and niece, nephew, family, and friends, I have never loved as much or had as much positivity as you talked about since raising these 2 dogs. Mm-hmm. Because you are giving and giving and ultimately giving them away to someone you don't know and who you meet at graduation. I've never sobbed harder, you know, when I turned the first dog in. But yet to know that we're doing something that can give another person, such as yourself, the freedom to do what you want to do with your life just makes it all worthwhile. So I want to thank you for how you talked about that. The other issue we have, though, is that people are not always so tolerant of guide dog puppies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm not talking about anyone here. But you know, when we bring them places, and they are dogs, and they bark occasionally, you know, we do take her out when she does that. But if we don't socialize the dogs, because that's what we do for 15 months, we don't
Correct.
Train them, we socialize
Correct.
Them until they go in for formal training.
You bet.
But if we don't take them to the variety of places that they will ultimately need to go to, then they won't be able to be a well-socialized guide dog, you know, and have that kind of independence. So I don't know if you have any suggestions for that.
Well, I have a couple questions. One, is this for Guide Dogs of America?
Yes, it is.
Great. So that's a Los Angeles-based guide dog school. It's wonderful.
They're in Sylmar?
Yep.
And they do have a history of Guide Dogs of America book.
Yep. They're a wonderful organization. There are about a dozen guide dog schools in the U.S. Guide Dogs of America is one of the better ones. It's terrific, great program.
And they need puppy raisers.
They always need puppy raisers. So if you're feeling a volunteerism urge sprouting within you, you know, like a wonderful hairy tree, you know, they can use your help. But I would imagine the GDA has some ideas about this through their puppy program. I don't know that this is true, but I'm just, it's a guess.
They're very helpful, yes.
Yeah, the second thing is that there are businesses and shopping malls and organizations that really get it, and then there are ones that don't, and then you have to educate them. And in an odd way, that's to be in the same position that the guide dog user has to be in, to be a bit of an ambassador. And that's tiring, and sometimes it's even a little maddening. Most places want to be identified with and associated with good conduct, but you can run into people who really don't care. And in that instance, then you just have to find a different place to socialize the dog, because you can't batter your head against concrete either. You know, if you can't bring them around. Different states have different laws. In New York, guide dog puppies in training are allowed everywhere, but I don't know about California.
In California, they have no legal rights.
Well, then that has to happen, doesn't it?
One would hope, yeah. They do wear jackets, but they don't have any legal rights.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. We're so thrilled. Thank you so much for tonight.
Other questions?
My question is, if your mother was a different type of mother that acknowledged your lack of sight, do you think you might not have accomplished what you have accomplished because of a different expectation that she might have had?
I think I would have gotten there sooner. I think that the thing in me that loves poetry and music and jazz and philosophy and literature, I think that's pretty much a central part of who I am. I think I would have been a happier traveler sooner. And I don't think that having gotten there late is in some way contingent upon a school of hard knocks that I needed in order to turn that corner. I don't regret, having spent half my 20s and 30s laboring toward who I became. I don't look back at that and go, that was spilled wine.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't think that would be the case. I think I'd have been happier sooner.
Thank you.
Which should be everybody's right, by the way.
Happier sooner.
Healthcare is a right. Being happier is a right. Being comfortable in your own skin is a right.
Question back there.
Dogs have a much keener sense of smell than humans. When you started, your consciousness started melding with your guide dogs, do you think your sense of smell became keener?
There's a whole hilarious section in the book where I just let the dog go around smelling things, and I'm following her in weird locations, trying to imagine what it is she's smelling. Like the ghosts of prairie animals and, I think dogs have 10,000 times our ability to smell. And they smell things that were there 20 years ago. And it's fun to think about that.
But when they're stopping, you said they're looking ahead. So literally, their sight isn't, they're not bred for their sight. Their smell is their great. But the guide dog is seeing.
Dogs have better vision than you would suppose. They're predators, which means one, they can see great at night. Two, the average dog has a Labrador, for instance, has 280 degrees of vision staring straight ahead.
Wow.
Versus 110 for a human being.
Wow, didn't know that.
So they can be staring straight ahead and not even looking left or right, and they can see what's a block up.
Okay.
So their vision is actually pretty damn great. They're not like voles or you know, bats or something that, you know.
But that's a very inventive question. Let's have.
By the way, dogs do see color. You know, that's also a a general misapprehension about dogs that they see in black and white. We know now that they do see color, more like pastels, but they do see color, and they're particularly good at seeing things moving,
like squirrels.
Yeah, absolutely.
Next question.
Hi, we haven't talked at all about your role as one of our, I've long read you as a parent of a severely disabled daughter, and I'm sure everyone, or maybe everyone doesn't know that you are a very esteemed and revered champion for the rights of the disabled, even the cognitively disabled, which are often overlooked. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit, or where do you think we are today as a culture with disability rights, and particularly in your work that you're doing in the university level, in awareness, in rights, in what's going on in the larger, I mean, you don't have to answer all of that, but I mostly wanted to make everyone aware that it's not only, you know, are you a beautiful poet and an incredibly empathetic man and proponent for what you're doing here, but what you've meant to many of us in the country who have children with severe disabilities. I mean, I'm filled with gratitude for that, but I'm also curious, given the state that we're in right now, politically, what you think is going to happen to us.
Thank you.
That's terrific. Thank you. So first of all, I should tell folks that I have many friends who are autistics, many of them non-speaking, who communicate via typing, who are among the most inventive and wonderful poets and intellectuals that I know. I am absolutely admiring of people who are branded as cognitively impaired, who persist because still waters run deep and they have tremendous capacities for both imagining and functioning in ways that the general public does not understand. And I probably said that with a little less elegance than I would have liked to, but I'm on the verge of getting emotional. I think that the obstacles for people with disabilities remain great. I think the current political moment is a dangerous one, not only for people of color and women and minorities who hail from other nations, immigrants and so forth, but also for people with disabilities. And let's be clear that the GOP in the House has attempted to overturn large portions of the Americans with Disabilities Act over the last few months. Those efforts have stalled in the Senate right now. But if you don't think your vote matters, think again, because there are forces at work right now that would like to undermine the ADA, just as there are forces at work right now that want to undermine freedom of the press, a woman's right to choose, the opportunity to vote freely, the opportunity to have health care. I see these things as all equally important and intersectional and dynamic and important and critical. I think the disabled are in a fight for their lives right now, and I won't, you know, pretend that that isn't the case. So I wake up every day thinking about these things. There is a lot of ableism in the culture. Ableism is, of course, the belief that in order to be successful and have value, you need to have a healthy body, and a body that looks like other healthy bodies. And if there is something, untoward and eccentric about your body, then you lack all value. And if you don't think that that system is still very much in place, particularly in the educational milieu, go check it out. You know, college students with disabilities are 75% less likely to graduate than students without disabilities. We continue to sequester the disabled into special offices, failing to see disability as part of the cultural patchwork of inclusion and diversity. We think that some special office should handle that. Where does that idea come from? It comes from the 19th century, when they began to take disabled people out of mainstream culture and put them in asylums. Colleges and universities still function this way. There's a special office for you, dearie. Go over there. Well, you know, I mean, disability is about the mainstream. It's about the civic center of our nation. That's what disability rights means. It's what disability activism means. It's what people like me fight for, and what many of you here who are yourselves disabled or have friends or family who are disabled are fighting for. And, you know, I think about this all the time. We're starting a new institute at Syracuse devoted to disability, not only in the law, but also in culture. And I'm proud to be a part of that kind of work. But the work is still steep, it's still vital, it's still necessary, and I fear that under the current regime in Washington, that lives are in the balance.
Thank you for asking that question. It's a really important one. We have time for one more question, and then if you might be able to ask Steve some questions during the book signing. One over there.
Is there a protocol for saying goodbye to a guide dog?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I mean, no two people are alike. No two dogs are alike. And, you know, how to say goodbye to an animal that is suffering and needs to cross the rainbow bridge to the next place, where do we get our strength to do that? I can only tell you that when it was the case that Corky was about to die, she had seizures and a brain tumor, and I was about to fall apart, I realized that she had devoted her life to making sure I was okay. And therefore, I would devote her last seconds to making sure that she knew that I was okay. So I held her and I sang to her as she died. And then I fell apart. And that was a little thing I could give back to her. So she died hearing me singing to her. Thank you.
Thank you all so much. And we'll join you in a moment in the lobby.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.